move into the director's report. Director Anderson?
Thanks, and good morning, everybody. As usual, I'm going to go through a number of different issues, as providing the commission an update on a number of activities that have gone on since we last met. I want to start off by, you may recall, in January, Deputy Director Storr let you know that we were hiring and had hired a new community outreach coordinator. And Jason Wettstein is here in the front row there this morning, and he's, as I said, our new community outreach coordinator. He's going to be focusing on expanding our relationships with key stakeholders across the state, including outdoor-related businesses, conservation groups, and advocates for conservation and recreation. So we're pleased to have Jason on board. Another area that we placed a focus on this year, where we've been absent for a number of years due to budget cuts, is participation at sports shows. And we're, as Commissioner Carpenter knows, we're in the kind of the heart of the winter show season. And we've had staff from all of our programs, Fish, Wildlife, Habitat, and Enforcement, working on participating and having staff at a number of shows here this winter and several that are yet to come. We put together this banner that you have behind us as a consistent backdrop behind the displays and the booths that we have at the shows. Our wildlife program and public affairs unit have been coordinating the activity, but we've got an awful lot of the credit goes out to the regional staff from each of the programs who have attended the sports shows. So far, over in Region 3, we had staff at the Tri-City Sportsman Show in Pasco. Then in Region 6, the Washington Sportsman Show in Puyallup here that was just, I think, last weekend and at the end of January. Region 4 folks staffed the booth at the Seattle Boat Show. And then Region 5 staff, just going on as we are meeting here this week, at the Pacific Northwest Sportsman Show in Portland. I've got a couple of other shows that are upcoming. The Central Washington Sportsman Show in Yakima will be having staff be there at a booth. That's February 15th through the 17th. And then the Wenatchee Valley Sportsman Show, February 22nd through the 24th. And the last one is the big show, the Big Horn Adventure Show in Spokane, March 21st through the 24th. So, and we're also have implemented a system through Bruce Bodka so that we can evaluate the effectiveness of those, the value of those, keeping track of the number of contacts, the kinds of questions, because there's a huge staff investment to do this number of shows, especially when you take on one like the boat show where it's 10 consecutive days. We want to make sure, and so it certainly does come at a cost, and we want to make sure that we're getting the maximum benefit in terms of our interactions with stakeholders for our efforts. Big shifting gears in a pretty big way, turning to pocket gophers. The issue of pocket gophers, the proposed listing of pocket gophers by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We're going to be submitting some initial written comments to the service concerning that potential listing under the Endangered Species Act. Our deadline to get those comments in is February 11th, which is Monday. Some of you know these. This particular critter is present in the prairie areas around Thurston County and surrounding areas, and including Joint Base Lewis-McChord. There's also a presence out in the prairie area where the Olympia Airport is, and there's been a number of restrictions placed on development as a result of the state listing, and as well as restrictions that have been put in place by the counties to try to provide protection for this animal. Our comments are going to focus on our concerns regarding the service's conclusions about the occurrence of up to 4 subspecies, pointing out that additional DNA work is being pursued that will better inform a decision about whether or not we actually have those subspecies present in the population. We're also going to, point out our belief that there are adequate regulatory mechanisms in place at the local level to provide protection for pocket gophers in Washington. I'll be stepping out a little later in the morning to meet with the governor's staff on this topic, as I've been ensuring that the governor's staff is aware that we're going to be making comments to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And in this particular case, we do have a different perspective and view on the science around pocket gophers, and we believe there is some additional information forthcoming that would help inform a decision, and we're encouraging them to wait to make that decision until that additional information comes forward. On the issue of the Columbia River policy implementation, I don't have a real detailed report for you, but to let you know that we have formed an implementation team that includes, of course, folks here in headquarters as well as Region 5 and Region 6. We got our group together for the first time here earlier this week, looking at several different immediate focus areas in terms, including the additional studies that are needed to ascertain long-term mortality rates with the use of alternative gears, testing new off-channel sites, often referred to as safe areas, but with a particular focus on the Cathlamet channel, and discussing about how we're going to make progress and move forward relative to the development of a buyback program over the course of the next year. And you'll recall that the policy calls for us to have that program developed by the end of 2013. There's also been an issue raised with regard to the potential transfer of effort from people who have historically fished in the Columbia to the Willapa and or Grace Harbor, but more so the Willapa than Grace Harbor. Obviously there's a transition period in the policy, so the gillnet fishery in the Columbia in 2013 is going to play out similarly to what it did in 2012 and 2011. So this effort transfer issue, if it occurs, will likely occur in as we go through the transition and the allocation changes occur, the shift to alternative gear occurs. Those individuals that may not wish to look at an alternative gear, that kind of a change in their fishing practices. And you'll recall that we have three gillnet licenses of Puget Sound, which is solely for the waters in Puget Sound. We have a Grace Harbor Columbia River license, and we have a Willapa Columbia River license. So that is where the concern is that if you have a Willapa Columbia River license and you have typically fished primarily in the Columbia, we may see a transfer of effort into the Willapa. So we're going to be looking at doing a phone survey of all the gillnet license holders for those two license types, to begin to give us a sense on the potential and the magnitude if an effort shift is to occur, so that we can ensure that we have the appropriate in-season monitoring tools in place, because our models that we have are predicated on a historic number of vessels participating in that fishery. And if we see a greater number of vessels participating, it could impact the harvest rate, our harvest rate assumptions on those fisheries. So there is a potential connection and consequence to the gillnet fisheries in Willapa and Grace Harbor, and I say less so in Grace Harbor because the opportunity in Grace Harbor is less than it is in the Willapa. We do have a number of licenses that there's about half the Columbia River Willapa gillnet licenses had at least one delivery in out of Willapa last year, so I believe the number is 99. I believe the total number of licenses is 194. So there's a pretty significant number of licenses that have not been fishing in Willapa. We tend to use the term safe areas and apply it in a number of different ways. I mean, the term safe area in the Columbia River is an area where you can target hatchery fish with a minimal impact on listed species, right? So in the Willapa, we don't have any listed species. So when we're talking about, we may need to find another term in terms if we're going to augment production in the Willapa in order to provide new opportunity or for commercial gillnet fishing or commercial fishing, maybe regardless of the gear type. It's in a different context than the safe areas. I'm going to turn to Grace Harbor, Chinook, for a moment. You'll recall that Francis Estalia came before the commission in January and was offering, I think he characterized it as a report card of how the management of Grace Harbor Chinook was going. You may recall he referenced the development of a Grace Harbor management plan. And so I wanted to just give a little bit of a response and update to you with regard to Grace Harbor Chinook. There are two primary stocks in Grace Harbor, the Chehalis wild run of Chinook and the wild run of Chinook that returns to the hump tulips. There are also pop subpopulations that go into places like the Wainuchi and the Wishkaw, probably Johns River, Elk River. But the two populations that we predicate our management on are the Chehalis stock and hump tulips. I'm going to primarily speak to Chehalis Chinook because they make up the bulk of the wild run. And they are a far north migrating stock. So we see impacts on that stock in southeast Alaska. We see greater impacts along the west coast of British Columbia. There are relatively small impacts south of the U.S.-Canada border in ocean fisheries on Grace Harbor Chinook, like less than a 5% exploitation rate on the stock. A little bit unique in that 90%+ of the Chinook that return to Grace Harbor are wild origin, not hatchery origin, so it truly is an area where if we're going to have a directed fishery, it's directed on a wild stock. It's also a little bit unique in that both of Chehalis and hump tulip stocks we manage for what we call a fixed escapement goal. Whereas if you look at other Chinook stocks along the coast or in the Columbia River, we're managing with a harvest rate, or in some cases, an exploitation rate. So what is the total proportion of the abundance of the population that is taken in fisheries where that exploitation rate is derived? And in some cases, particularly along the coast, we also have escapement floors. So it's an exploitation rate, but not to have the escapement go below a specific numerical value that's expressed as a floor. It is co-managed with the Quinault Indian Nation, and there are also impacts on the Chehalis Chinook by the Chehalis tribe. Chehalis tribe are not a treaty tribe. Their share does not come off the tribal share. The fish caught by the Chehalis tribe come off the non-treaty share. The Chehalis tribe fishes for spring Chinook, and they also fish for fall fish. So now, just turning a little bit to talk about, well, what's happened in terms of the performance of the stock, and I'm using the last 9 years, not including this year. I don't have final data for what the return was in 2012. So the number of we had 3 out of the last 9 years where the number of fish that spawned exceeded our escapement goal, and our escapement goal for Chehalis is 12,364, and for the hump tulips it's 2,236. So I'm going to have to be careful here that I don't talk too long. So 3 out of the last 9 years we exceeded the escapement goal. 3 out of the last 9 years the number of fish that spawned were within 10% of the goal. And in 2 years, which were 2007 and 2009, the number was less than 10% of the, that's not going to come out right. It was less than 90% of the goal. And in particular 2009, it was significantly less, like in the 5,500. And I believe in 2007, it was around 73 or 400. We certainly recognize the importance of the population and the complexity of the management. And it, even though it's a lot smaller than the Columbia River drainage, the complexity of it and the number of areas where it has a subset of advocates is similar. That is to say that we have people who focus on the Hump Tulips River. We have people that focus on the estuary area and want to fish there. We have people that want to fish in the main stem between Aberdeen and Montesano. And we have people that want to fish in the tributaries. And we want to have people that want to fish in the upper reaches of the river. It's gotten a lot of attention. You may have seen some emails from Dave Hamilton, who's also done a number of public disclosure requests. I believe we provided him over 40,000 pages in response to public disclosure requests. So, and he has a website where he has put that information up. And so Grace Harbor has always represented a big challenge for us in terms of management, and it shows no signs of becoming any less difficult this year and in years to come. So Grace Harbor Chinook are north migrating A lot of the harvest takes place outside of areas where we have any control. Relatively a low productivity in that stock. I think we've seen years where we've had 15, 17, 18,000 fish return, again, measured against that 12,000 fish goal. So we've had some years where there's been some abundance of fish, but I think the future is likely going to be much like the past in that we're going to have a relatively small amount of access and harvestable opportunity on those fish, and we're going to be playing around in that 11,000 to 16, 17,000 return area and hopefully staying away from those really low years where I don't know if it's obvious, but where ocean environmental conditions seem to play a pretty big role in those kinds of big declines in total abundance. I'm going to switch to wolves.
Can we ask some questions before? Because this is what you just talked about, very interesting subject. And I think the Fish Committee discussed it last night. Commissioner Menken?
Yeah, thank you, Phil. You've described what appears to be an intractable situation. Do you have any suggestions as to how we can improve the situation on the Chehalis?
I think we can continue to do our due diligence in terms of habitat protection and restoration. We can continue our participation and try to influence the outcomes in the Pacific Salmon Commission forum, where the aggregate abundance-based management approach is used off the west coast of Vancouver Island. And we can continue to work closely with the Quinault Indian Nation in trying to manage hump tulip and Chehalis origin stocks separately rather than as an aggregate. And our other challenge is to get a greater degree of cooperation from the Chehalis tribe in terms of sharing data.
Thank you.
Before we leave this subject, I might not be understanding what Francis Estalila talked about, but I think one of his points that I'd like you to address either now or later was the point having to do with managing for paper fish, harvesting on the basis of models, and then not really knowing exactly how many real fish have been harvested or real fish have returned. Because I was hearing him say a number of times, and he's testified before us, that that he and probably other members of the public believe that we don't really have actual numbers. We're just managing on the basis of models. And those he describes as paper fish. Is that one of his points, too, in your view? Is that legitimate?
I'm not going to try to suggest that I know what his points are. I did hear the paper fish piece. In terms of knowing what the actual returns are, our stream sampling program, where those spawning escapement estimates are derived from, I think are very good. We've got really good staff in Region 6. We've got a very comprehensive program of doing of stream surveys, historic indexes, which is where we get our estimates. Do we count ever? Do we see and count every fish? Of course not. But we use these index areas where we're going back every year, looking at them as a means of estimating the number of spawners. We manage fisheries in a world of making estimates on pre-season forecasts of abundance. And we live in a world that if we're going to provide for harvest opportunity, we're going to have to rely on those models. We need to make every effort where we have models that are showing inconsistent results with actual numbers of fish. We need to be aggressive about making either modifications or improvements to the model, or including conservation buffers in recognition of the poor performance of a model. It's easy in cases where the actual number of fish is below and particularly significantly below what you have forecasted, you are modeling the harvest of paper fish because they don't exist. You don't know that they don't exist until they return and you find out that your forecast overestimated the population. So in years, particularly in 07 and 09, where we had some pretty significant, very significant, our models predicted the fish to return at a low level, but not as low as they actually did. The other point, of course, is that when we have forecasts of that population to return below spawner escapement level, we're not having any directed fisheries on them, and we're looking at and limiting even the ability of the fisheries to target on coho, for example, because of the bycatch and the mortality, release mortality of Chinook. So I guess the bottom, maybe my response is, when we have the run underperforms or performs in a manner that's less than forecast, the fish that you are modeling to be caught, are some of those are going to be paper fish because they don't exist.
Okay. Commissioner Duvia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Director, do you know the size of the Chehalis tribe membership?
Seven people?
No. I could give you a guess, but I don't think that it'd be worth much.
Can you give a range?
I'd rather get back to you on that.
Okay. Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Phil, for that presentation. You know, the modeling tool that is used in all of our fisheries is the staff puts in tons of time and critiques it and analyzes it, and it works pretty well most of the time, but there are some anomalies that it just can't foresee. One of the impediments that the department has now in 2013 is waiting on our colleagues across north of the border to come up with their abundance analysis, and I guess Phil or Pat and all of those of us are again going to be in Portland Monday for pre-season Pacific Salmon Commission meetings. Any indication that they're going to have data available next week, or will it be in early April again?
I brought this issue to the attention of the Canadians at the Pacific Salmon Commission meeting in October, and we had an opportunity. I was pretty pleased by the response, not only from the Canadians, but from just the Chinook Technical committee. That committee is jointly chaired by an individual from the United States and from Canada. And they almost immediately identified a way to get the information to us at least a week earlier than what it has traditionally been provided to us. We had another discussion on that matter in at the January Commission meeting. And so I'm pretty hopeful that through that request to the Canadians and talking with the Chinook Technical Committee, which is who receives that information from the Canadians and then provides us the inputs to our FRAM model, our Fishery Regulation Assessment Model, that we're going to get that information earlier this year than we have in previous years. We still won't have it when we do our initial formulation and development of the three ocean options in the second week of March, but at the same time, I'm guardedly optimistic we're going to have it before we get to the second EFMC meeting and before we have our last week of kind of formal North Falcon meetings the week prior to that, which is the box we've been in the last couple of years.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just one last note on Grace Harbor. You've heard me and others, Ron Warren, Jim Scott, reference this Grace Harbor management plan that we developed. I want to say it was in 2007 because of the complexity that I mentioned and the competition between interests as to when to catch, how much to catch, how to distribute harvestable numbers of fish, that we developed this tier system that based on what the expected abundance was, that we hardwired some management responses in terms of fisheries. So at very low levels, where we were at the goal or we were 110% of the goal or less, that we had a management response where we had no directed fisheries, we had another tier, if you were above that a little bit, then here's what happened. And we were, frankly, kind of test driving that. It was kind of a new approach. And so what we are intending to do is to get our advisory group back together and start to work through and update that management plan with the idea of bringing it to the commission. I'm going to say November-ish of 2013 for your review, and then we can discuss whether that's a plan that's director approved or whether it's a plan that the commission wants to approve or review. So that's also on our horizon for Grace Harbor.
Great. Thank you.
So now I'm going to pass this. This is a wolf management update. I'm not going to read it all. I'm going to highlight a few parts of it. I'll leave the rest of it for you to read, and if you have questions, let me know, and we'll do our best to get the answers. So many of you, if not all of you, know that we recently held three meetings on wolf management in January. We had one in Spokane, Olympia, and Seattle. They were all very well attended, 100-plus people, 200-plus. We wanted to use these as an opportunity to update the public on the status of wolves in Washington and also provide the public an opportunity to hear from and talk with lead wolf experts, and you'll see that those included Mike Jimenez, Rocky Mountain Wolf Coordinator for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Wyoming, Carter Niemeyer, retired wolf specialist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and U.S. Department of Agricultural's Wildlife Services, and then Donnie Martorello from DFW were the three principal presenters. I went to one of them, really informative, brought different perspectives to the table, and I thought it really gave us an opportunity to talk with members of the public who don't normally have an opportunity to get down into some of the management challenges that we have and how we are responding to those management challenges. Livestock conflict in particular was discussed at length, and how we're trying to tailor our management based on what we've learned as well as what we've learned from the experiences from other states and other agencies. We have three additional meetings that have a little different purpose in February, early March, to talk about our, you know, updating those folks on wolf management status and the status of wolves, but also with a particular focus on addressing wolf livestock conflicts. So we've got, those are going to be up in the northeast part of the state where the majority of our wolf population is, up in Ponderay, Stevens, and Okanagan counties, and you can see when those are going to be held. Also wanted to let you know that we've had some recent changes in our staffing related to wolf management. Our new conflict section manager, Stephanie Simic, started in January. We have a new conflict specialist, has been a previous employee, but new to this position, Jay Shepard, out of Colville. And then, unfortunately, sorry to report that Paul Frame is leaving us for a job in Quebec where he'll be trying to capture polar bears. So I don't know whether that's going to be more fun than he had with us, but it's going to leave a big hole, and we're actively out there recruiting for that position. You may also recall that there is a provision for two advisory groups in the Wolf Conservation Management Plan that have not been formed yet, and you'll see that we are moving forward with both that citizen advisory group and the Wolf Interagency Committee that are called for in the management plan. And then just on the field activities, excuse me, at the bottom of the page, you'll see the results of our aerial wolf surveys estimating pack size and numbers of successful breeding pairs. 11 packs, 9 confirmed, 2 suspected, minimum count of 51 with an estimated population of just over 100, 5 successful breeding pairs. Then you can see how those results compare to 2011, where we've got a pretty significant increase in number of breeding pairs, as well as an increase in the total number of wolves we actually saw and counted, and then, of course, an increase in the total number of packs confirmed. We're doing some additional area wolf captures later this month, trying to use that as a more effective technique for capturing and collaring packs at Tianaway, the Diamond, Smackout, Salmo, and Huckleberry packs. We're continuing to meet with livestock producers to establish these damage prevention cooperative agreements. Really pleased to report we've got 14 agreements have been signed by producers in different parts of the state, so Dave Ware has been really working hard on that and finding quite a little bit of success. We also had hearings on a number of different bills before the legislature that Joe will talk a little bit about in a minute, but both the hearings in the House and the Senate, I view it as a positive outcome. Got a lot of support for the conservation management plan from both sides of the aisle, and both from a legislative perspective as well as a public perspective. So we'll talk a little bit more about those. Also have been spending some time down in the Blue Mountains, and you'll see some narrative about that, about what we found down there, and meeting with livestock operators down there, a couple in particular who had reported losses of 10 to 12 animals this last season. And you also see the results of some aerial surveys that Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife did, where they observed 8 black and 2 gray wolves on an open ridge in the Tucannon drainage. I'll stop there. There's other information in here that I hope you'll find informative. And then finally, under the category of other stuff, Commissioner Carpenter and I and Jim Scott participated in a meeting that was actually held at the boat show last week, where NOAA Fisheries came and met with a number of recreational interest representatives at their request. And it was appreciated them inviting us to be there as well. A lot of topics discussed, from everything from the Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan to hatchery reform, talking about the green, talking about the Skokomish in particular, Mitchell Act funding, MAFAC appointments, which is an acronym that I was trying to remember what all the letters stand for. It's a marine advisory group that's established by NOAA Fisheries headquarters. And we had an individual, Kevin Lanier, who is one of our recreational interests here in Washington, apply for a position, and I just learned yesterday that he was selected, so that was good news. And Kevin was at this meeting, we spent about 2.5 hours or something like that, and I thought had a good discussion. Still making some good contacts with Governor Inslee and Governor Inslee's staff over the past couple of weeks. I've had 3 cabinet meetings so far. They've established a sub-cabinet of agencies dealing with energy, environment, and climate that we're on. I've also established a legislative liaison group from representing those areas of interest that Ann Larson's been participating on. When they've chosen to have this sub-cabinet meet, unfortunately, is on Fridays between, I think, 8 to 9 o'clock, which there'll be some conflicts with the commission's conference calls for the next, at least 4 meetings, the February 15th, March 15th, April 5th, and April 19th meeting, and we may want to talk with you about your ability to start those at a later time in the morning, to see if that works. 10:30 was the time we were thinking about, but I'd like to have you think about that a little bit. Pacific Salmon Commission's next week, so Papatillo and myself and a whole bunch of folks, John Long and Kyle Addicks and Ron Warren, and I won't begin to name all the folks that are going to be part of that, or going down to that. We've also had a request from the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission to attend a meeting with them where they want to talk about enforcement. And in particular, they want to talk about our officers enforcing boating safety laws against tribal fishers when they board tribal vessels. They want to talk about Department of Fish and Wildlife regulatory authority over tribal buying activities off-reservation. And there's also a concern expressed that state officers are focusing a disproportionate amount of their time in checking tribal vessels instead of non-treaty vessels. So we're going to be meeting with them at the end of this month on some of those topics. And then very last, I know you're all thankful for that, is the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission recently adopted a hatchery policy, and I'm handing that policy around. And again, I'm not going to go through it in a lot of detail, but there is some significant pieces in there. Not surprising, it emphasizes the role of salmon and steelhead hatcheries in implementing their treaty right to fish, as well as recovering salmon populations. The policy statement contains things such as hatcheries will remain an integral and indispensable component of salmon management to meet the requirements of U.S. v. Washington and O.V. Baldridge. Part of the hatchery fish are part of the federally recognized treaty right. Hatchery programs are to consider the unique status of watersheds. Watersheds that are heavily degraded are likely to require long-term or permanent hatchery production to support salmon populations sufficient to carry out the treaty right. They may have a statement in there about hatcheries being important to conservation in terms of a supplementation tool, rebuilding depressed natural populations. And I thought that the last one on the last page was particularly interesting. Changes to hatchery programs in response to science recommendations cannot be successfully implemented without integrating many non-technical factors and risks, including but not limited to legally authorized and mandated mitigation obligations, tribal treaty reserve fishing rights, logistical challenges and infrastructure constraints, and funding and operating budgets for implementing the changes and monitoring their effectiveness. So those are just a couple of the pieces that I picked out of the policy as I read through it that were, I thought, interesting. And it certainly is consistent with what we've been hearing from the tribes, and you'll also see a direct linkage between habitat degradation, the loss of, and the corresponding loss of natural spawning populations, and the continuing need to have hatchery production to offset the losses of that production in terms of fulfilling the treaty right from the tribe's perspective. So I think I'm sure I've gone over. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
We've got a couple questions. Commissioner Jennings?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I held my questions back till the end. Actually, I want to go back to the pocket gopher briefly. The Endangered Species Act, while it focuses on individual species, sort of larger overriding reason for it is also to look at the habitat and other plant and animal communities associated with that species, so that that species is more of an indicator of the loss. And over 10 years ago, I was fortunate enough to participate in a conference sponsored, I think, both by the UW and Department of Fish and Wildlife on South Puget Sound prairies. And back then, I think that was prior to 1999, less than 3% of our Puget Sound prairies were in anything approaching good quality habitat. Our prairies are fire subclimax. That means that with the absence of fire, the prairies tend to go away. A lot of that fire was man-made over the last several thousand years. And those fires have really decreased over time with the increased population densities we have. At this point, and now with the invasive species like scotch broom, it makes it even harder to keep those prairie habitats, true prairie habitats. We have a variety of species associated and dependent on them, pocket gophers being one. My main point in saying that is that while I understand we want to make sure that the best science is used for coming up with an endangered species determination or not for our populations of pocket gophers, it really doesn't negate our challenge to keep that habitat functioning for pocket gophers and a variety of other species we have. And I think we have some real challenges there because those areas are often targeted for development, targeted for, in the case of Scatter Creek, other activities that may or may not be compatible with long-term prairie sustainable habitats. And so I'll just stop there, but I think we have a challenge with not only the pocket gopher potential listing, but just the overall question of how do we maintain, enhance, and increase the percent of the prairies that we have left, because we're looking at, less at this point, probably less than 2% of the original habitat for prairies in South Puget Sound.
I would just say I don't disagree with anything you said. I think in our surveys that we've done in the last 12 months, we're finding presence of pocket gophers in places outside just the prairie areas. And if they're going to list them and they're going to list the subspecies, we want to make sure that they're doing so, identifying subspecies with good science. But really the bigger issue here is we have, the local, from my perspective, the local community government, from the port districts to the school districts of Tumwater, have stepped up with ordinances and regulatory mechanisms to provide protection of a lot of the areas that where we have pocket gophers present. And so the question is, if you have, and they're essentially letting JBLM, they're saying what you're doing is fine. But so part of the discussion here is whether under state and local management and regulatory mechanisms, are we providing the necessary protection, and therefore a listing may be warranted but preempted because of the steps taken at the local level to protect the species in question. So
right, and my comment for meant is in any way criticism.
Yeah, no.
It's more that recognition of the overall challenge and for that habitat.
Commissioner Schmidt.
Thank you, Chair. Just a comment on the tribal requested meeting on enforcement. I see that could become an opportunity for both sides. Certainly, we need to attend to their agenda items, but that becomes an opportunity for us to put our agenda items on enforcement on the table. And perhaps this can be a very candid discussion of those issues. Tribal enforcement has always been a curiosity of when, where, and how, and can we do it together. And this is a chance to open the big issue of catch accountability. So I see this is not bad at all. It's good for the two sides to take this issue up.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with what Commissioner Smitten said. I guess I wanted to ask one protocol question, Phil, on the same letter. Is this a letter that you take as their position, or is this a letter that you review and respond? How does that work?
The request to meet regarding enforcement, or the letter, the policy letter?
The policy letter.
The letter was, I think, sent to us to make us aware of the action by the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission to adopt the policy. I don't... the last paragraph talks about we look forward to your support in implementing these principles as we move forward. And so I think there's a lot of things in here that we can be supportive of. And there's a few things in there that there's kind of more to the story. If I read between the lines, I may read some things in there that may not be consistent with the commission's policy. So I think it was a courtesy copy. It was a copy to let us know what their policy is as it relates to hatcheries, and how they view hatchery production as it relates to their treaty right. I'm not planning a response to them commenting on their policy.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Hey, Deputy Director Storr.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm going to today pinch hit for Ann Larson. As the director said, Ann is over at the governor's office in a cross-agency legislative liaison coordinating meeting. So you'll have to maybe put up with a little less familiarity, and I'll probably talk a lot slower to
fill up the time.
Well, there's just probably fewer nerve synapses that remain. So you should have a handout that talks about a little bit about budget, and then spend some time talking about some of the significant hearing events of this week and next week, and then finally I'll highlight a few of the bills I think are of more interest to you. As far as budget goes, we're still hearing that Governor Inslee may not be rolling out his own budget. Remember, Governor Gregoire put hers out in December, and that's kind of sitting on the table. And then what typically happens is the legislature waits for the March forecast, with the session ending in mid-April. The March revenue forecast is often the basis for the House and the Senate to construct their budgets. And again, not hearing, and this may not be, we're not hearing much, frankly, but not hearing that Governor Inslee intends to roll out a fourth budget in addition to House, Senate, and Gregoire's. But we will see. We are hearing that some of budget-related initiatives ought to be coming out from the governor's office between now and the March forecast, so stay tuned. I don't have an idea what those are, but I think there's some stage setting being contemplated there. Moving on to the legislative highlights of this week, there were four primary, I think, most interest work sessions or hearings. The first was last Tuesday in House Agriculture and Natural Resources. The director mentioned our Wolf Day work session. Four bills there in the subsequent hearing got some attention. The first, 1191, allows originally for lethal take for all predators. That has since been amended to just wolves. So if a wolf was to attack a person or livestock, this bill that was sponsored by Representative Short and Representative Blake, bipartisan, would allow lethal take of that particular wolf in this instance. Our bill, 1219, which, just as a reminder, does a number of things. Adds the gray wolf to the list of big game species, removes the condition that a livestock owner must raise livestock for sale in order to qualify for wildlife damage compensation, allows a state wildlife account to be used for compensating the owners of livestock for damage caused by wild carnivores, and finally creates a special wolf license plate to help fund wolf management. This was our agency-sponsored bill that got some attention. House Bill 1337, which makes state delisting of wolves concurrent or along the same timeline as federal actions on delisting. That bill probably isn't moving, but was part of the discussion. And then House Bill 1501, which primarily what it does is it establishes an unappropriated funding source to implement the wolf plan. So dollars from a potential license plate or dollars that are appropriated by the legislature from the wildlife fund would go into a new separate unappropriated account to implement the wolf plan. More to come on those in a minute as I talk about next week and where we think some of those what's going to happen with some of those bills. Another significant event this week was on Tuesday again, the Senate Natural Resources and Parks. There are probably 8 Discover Pass bills that are out there in the House and Senate. And so this was a hearing day. I think the general theme that we're seeing on Discover Pass is there's a sense of trying to combine some of those ideas. There's a lot of caution about exemptions that would have significant impacts to revenue. Big driver for all of that discussion is making sure parks, state parks, is left as whole as possible, given all the recent reductions. And so there's discussions about how much general fund ought to remain with parks versus the new revenue. And again, I'll talk about the specifics of a couple of those bills in just a minute. Another significant event this week was Wednesday, House Ag and Natural Resources, where all of our agency bills were executed out of committee. So our agency bills are all moving forward. In fact, the license revocation bill is already in rules. I think it's probably the most advanced of all these all the natural resources bills that are out there. On Thursday, yesterday, we had 2 work sessions and a hearing. There was a hydraulic project approval, forest practices approval, integration work session that went well. We had hunter safety public hearing where Chief Bjork was heavily engaged, and we had a work session on the Yakima Basin Integrated Water Plan, this whole notion of moving forward storage and fish passage and conservation issues together over a long-term plan in the Yakima Basin. So pretty busy, very busy week this last week. Next week, we have on Tuesday the House Ag and Natural Resource, the wolf bills that I mentioned before are some of those anyway are scheduled for executive session. Anticipate that bills that relate to funding of the plan, perhaps this bill that I mentioned sponsored by Representatives Short and Blake on attacks on people or livestock, those seem to be getting a lot of attention among all the wolf bills. On Wednesday, there's a House Ag and Natural Resources bill, and I don't have that number here, but it's around marine spatial planning. An update on that. In the Senate side, Senator Ranker was the prime sponsor for that one. On Wednesday, the 13th, in Senate Energy, Environment, and Telecommunications, there are public hearings on Senate Bill 5547, which has to deal with ocean acidification, and 5545, which has to do with working waterfront redevelopment. It's a Jobs Act. There's some issues there related to our hydraulic project approval permits that we're trying to work through with the Senate. And then finally on Thursday, Valentine's Day, in the House, Community Development, Housing, and Tribal Affairs, there are hearings on 2 tribal bills. 1495 has to do with tribal access to public lands, and 1496 has to do with enforcement on tribal lands or ceded areas, state enforcement versus tribal enforcement. So those are two you might want to take a look at. For new bills to come out, the cutoff calendar, just a reminder from the House of Origin, if it's a non-fiscal bill, has to move out of the House of Origin by out of that policy committee by February 22nd. If it has a fiscal impact, it has to move out by March 1st, and then off the floor from the House of Origin by the 13th. So we're about a month in, and we've got probably, we can expect to see a lot fewer new bills being introduced as these deadlines loom, and the scheduling for hearings of bills pretty much has to take place real soon if they're going to get a hearing and get out of those policy committees to move to the floor. So then I'll turn to the second page and talk about some of these significant bills a little more specifically. Again, the first set are our agency request bills, and as I said, all are moving well. The wolf management bills, the House Bill 1219 and Senate Bill 5193 are companion bills on wolf management. Alive and well. License revocation, I mentioned, this has to do with payment of child support or lack thereof, and loss of license and hunting while the license is lost, and lifetime bans. This was a Governor Gregoire request that we push this bill forward, and it's receiving a lot of positive support. The Hunter Ed Bill, our Hunter Ed Bill 1199, allows two fees, right? A $20 course fee and then a $10 administration fee for reissuance of Hunter Ed certification. So we recover our costs. Takes our staff about 20 minutes to a half an hour per reissuance of a recertification, and so we're recovering some costs for doing that. It also well, one of the changes from the bill you saw before is that the prohibition on hunting unaccompanied under the age of 14 was changed to be a civil infraction instead of a criminal misdemeanor in the original bill. And that seems to that's fine with our enforcement folks, and that seems to have given the bill a little more support. Let's see, the wolf bills, I think there are 10 total if you count companions, 10 wolf bills. There's a lot of interest in combining those and getting bipartisan support led by Representatives Litton and Kretz, and in the Senate by Senators Rolfus and Smith. So strong bipartisan discussions going on about combining those ideas. All of the bills that seem to have life are pretty supportive of the wolf management plan, as the director mentioned. So the plan's really sort of front and center for the most viable wolf bills. The House is expected to pass these wolf bills out next Tuesday, and the Senate's expected to pass bills out next week, but I don't have a date yet. Discover Pass, I think I mentioned the dynamics there, the eight different bills. One thing I wanted to point out was the three agencies have been working for the last 4 or 5 months on a business plan. And this business plan details our best ideas about how we design, make improvement designs to the pass, make it more durable, make it more legible, make it easier for people to carry around, but also gets into marketing. Two primary areas where we think there's some more revenue to be generated. One is emphasize the annual passes, the $30 passes versus the daily. The other has to do with bundling and making them available in retail stores. And so what I'm talking about there is the, for instance, you might have the sale of a hunting license and a Discover Pass at the same time, or you might have the sale of different parks products and the Discover Pass at the same time. More attractive packaging We're talking about making them available in Safeway or in Costco, so that the folks that are standing in line, instead of looking at the National Enquirer, they see a nice, attractive, come visit state lands kind of package. Building off some experience that our consultants have had in doing that kind of thing. So those kinds of ideas we're going to be developing and rolling out over the next 3 years. But there's a lot of interest in trying to get proactively ideas in front of the legislature about how we think revenue could be enhanced. So that's out there. There was an agency directors meeting last week between Director Anderson, Director Hawk, and Commissioner Goldmark, where a lot of discussion around what's working and what isn't. So from top to bottom, we're doing a lot of coordinating still on the Discover Pass and trying to keep that a viable revenue-generating mechanism for the agencies, but also make it the customer service and customer satisfaction around all of that more increased. Let's see, other bills of interest. There was the bill that I think you've all been interested in, 1189, which had to do with Fish and Wildlife Commission, was up for executive session and it was pulled. So it doesn't look at this point like it's moving out of committee. There's another bill, 1112, the science and policy bill that Representative Short has been working with us for about 3 years on. And this originally came out of the Wolf Plan and the notion of lack of high-quality science or lack of availability to science with the Wolf Plan. And over we've had a lot of good discussions with Representative Short. The bill that is out there now, 1112, would require us to post scientific references that we use in making significant agency management decisions. There's a definition of what significant decision is in the bill, and so it's a lot less cumbersome for us as we make decisions and move forward, and so we really appreciate Representative Short working with us on that one. I think another very important one that Deputy Chief Sensi has been working a lot on and Senator Ranker sponsoring is the seafood labeling bill, 5037. Does a number of things, including common names for two species of salmon, expands the allowable species names that can be used from the federal seafood list for non-salmon. It makes the customer... the quality of a customer purchase more verifiable. We think it's going to improve, the quality of what a customer would be purchasing in terms of seafood. May have some positive health benefits. So we're very positive about that bill. There's some others here that you can take a look at. I don't think I'll go through many more of them unless you have questions. So that's my substitute for Ann report.
Commissioner Smith?
Just a quick question, Joe. On the seafood labeling, could you give me an example that is designed to address, like, what was improper labeling?
One of the examples I've heard of most was labeling of Atlantic salmon as Pacific Coast or native or what you pick the label, Chinook, Coho, whatever, but inappropriate labeling. And so people paying top dollar for something that isn't true.
Thanks. Commissioner Quinton.
Thank you, Chair. Under the other bills of interest, I'm aware, and I don't know the bill number, that it's a bill directed at questionable use of public disclosure requests, and it's strongly supported by local governments. I heard an editorial over it out of Wenatchee, especially small governments. They have little staff to handle repetitive demands for comments. And I thought of this morning when the director said that there's been a request that's required 40,000 pages to be submitted. I would hope we're tracking that at least. I don't know if we are actively
commenting on it, but I think it's worth our while to look at.
Yeah, Commissioner Schmidt, we are actively tracking, and I'm scanning my list here, and I don't see it, but I think you're aware we get somewhere between 500 to 600 public disclosure requests each year. We have one staff person full-time just managing those requests, not to mention the activity that our staff have to put in to go through. It's a very, you know, it's a very important piece of business in terms of government transparency. It's very expensive for us to manage at the on the ground. So I think that we feel pretty positive, pretty good about how we respond to that large volume. But because it is a huge cost for us, we do pay attention to these bills, and they come up about every year, thoughts about how to either streamline it or make it more whatever. But
you're just following. And you know, there's a careful balance to be sought of the public's right to know versus an abuse of the request. So, you know, obviously we have to be cognizant of that.
Commissioner Perry, could you bring your mic closer to stretch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask a question. I don't know whether Joe will be able to handle this or not, but whether the department was supporting or had any opinion on several of the bills having to do with water in the Columbia Basin area, wells, water table that are being proposed, whether they would have any wildlife impact, whether the department has an opinion on those one way or the other.
Commissioner Perry, we've been involved. Dennis Beach, our regional director out of Region 2, has been one of our leads. We've been involved in the Columbia River Basin planning and water management integration for quite a while now, from its inception and before. So part of that discussion, I think you were probably referring to the Odessa area,
yeah,
where we're seeing groundwater wells that support a huge agricultural industry and a number of municipalities, smaller usually, but cities out in that basin, where the groundwater wells are dropping by up to 2 feet per year. And to put a new well in place, you're going down into literally ancient water. You're going down through basalt layers and grabbing water that has been there for a long, long time. So the concern, one of the big concerns early on, is how do you sustain that sort of industry, that economy, those cities and people, and at the same time not do damage to the main stem in terms of fish protection and all those other issues. So we are watching those. One of the concerns, I think you hit it directly. One of the concerns is as you repipe and replumb a system that was built in the 1930s, you create efficiencies, you move more water downstream, but you also, that whole area there, from potholes to down into Crab Creek, all the water that's there primarily is water that was pulled out for irrigation and has seeped through the groundwater and reappeared and created a whole series of wetlands and very important habitat for wildlife. So what's the balance as we look for water efficiency, but we want to maintain the habitat and the access for hunting and fishing and all of those attributes? Dennis has been right in the middle of discussions with the Federal Bureau of Reclamation, the Army Corps, the tribes, et cetera, on all that. We track those bills pretty closely.
Thank you.
Okay. Great. That concludes the director's report. Very informative. Thank you both. And we are right on time for our scheduled break, so let's come back at 10:30.